Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. In just a moment or two, we're going to meet one of the world's greatest living theologians, Hans Küng, a man who can trace his theological credentials right back as far as Vatican II in 1963, his engagement with this current Pope as fellow professors in the mid-60s, and right through the period of John Paul II up to the present. Hans Küng was in Australia in December and was quite prepared to talk about his history in the church and what he considers the crisis facing the planet. Dr. Küng, welcome to Sunday Night on ABC Radio.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be in Melbourne again. I was here the first time in 1971.
1971, in some ways, marks the high point of something you had given much of your life to, and that's the ecumenical movement. I'd like to talk about perhaps some of the reservations later on, but that moment, perhaps the late 60s, early 70s, saw the coming to fruition of many of the things you had worked for a long time, and in some ways the world is still benefiting from that.
Yes, it's true. I was proud to have 5 evenings in Wilson Hall of Trinity College. I think 1,200 persons attending these lectures, and that was certainly a high point here, to have it in an ecumenical way. And I gave lectures about Jesus, the troublemaker, Jesus, the peacemaker, the destiny of Jesus, and the church. In these days, it was a time of hope and joy. It was really joyful to be a Catholic.
The period coming out of the Second World War, there was a great interest in international cooperation. You saw many of the great institutions, international institutions founded, the United Nations, the World Council of Churches, the Catholic Church with its own rethinking that led to Vatican II. You were a great part of a movement there that not only had an influence here in Australia but around the world, and despite the reservations that some have about what's happened in recent years, many of those benefits remain. Globally, the church is a different place. The Protestant churches talk, Catholics talk more easily to Protestants. All of those things have been substantial changes.
I also think we should not forget these changes, which were extremely positive. If you compare the liturgy of the Catholic Church before the Council and now, it is really a great, great progress. We can talk to God in our own vernacular language. We have the participation of the laity. Of course, it always depends what you do with these reforms. There are worship services which are splendid, very interesting, also with music, modern music, etc. But it is possible to have today a very vivid liturgy, and we have a new estimation of the biblical message of the Bible. We have a better participation possible of the laity. And especially, as what you mentioned already, we have rather good ecumenical relations. I think it's also here in Australia very, very different from the earlier times. And I was also happy to see just before I came here to the room here in the convention center, 3 Australian bishops, Roman Catholic bishops, who were very enjoyed to find me in person, not only in books. And they told me there are 6 Roman Catholic bishops here in this Parliament of the World Religions. That's an indication that a lot of things changed. This would not have happened before the Second Vatican Council.
When you started out as a young theologian, what were the great ambitions you had for your walk? What did you feel you would like to contribute? And to what extent do you feel that those great changes over those years you mentioned did give some fruition, some satisfaction to the aims that you'd set out?
Well, when I decided to study theology, there was not yet the time for reforms. It was the time of Pius XII, who at the beginning made really good steps for a renewal of the biblical studies. But in the last period, when I was in Rome, he became very, very static. He was sick. He wasn't anymore able to direct the church. Really, it was a period of stagnation. So for me, as for many others, the election of Pope John the 23rd showed that another type of pope will come, but of course nobody expected that he would be, so to speak, revolutionary in his convocation of an ecumenical council. And I really believe he was the greatest pope of the 21st century. He changed our attitude towards the Jews. He changed our attitude towards Islam and the other religions. He gave a real impetus for the ecumenical movement among the Christian churches. And he opened the windows of the Vatican. And I think these days it was really a great hope in the church that we could even have intercommunion, that we could resolve the problems. That was the situation in the late 60s, in the 60s and in the beginning of the 70s. But all this changed, unfortunately.
You were part of a young group of theologians at the time who helped provide the context in which these things could change. Who, for you, were the great contributors? We talk, of course, of John the 23rd, but among your colleagues, who do you think were the great contributors?
Well, I think I would mention, in the first place, Yves Congar. I think nobody has done so much for a new understanding of the church and of church reform like this French Dominican. And this book on vraie et fausse réforme dans l'Église, the true and wrong false reform of the church, was a real breakthrough, even if it was immediately condemned by Rome. I think he was a certain time in the exile, but he was afterwards a very central figure in the council. I would, of course, also mention Henri de Lubac, but he became more conservative and did not contribute so much. From the German side, certainly Karl Rahner was the leading figure, this German Jesuit who opened so many doors in theology. And I think you would have also to mention then Schönu, then the Dutch Dominican Edward Schillebeeks, and also, of course, Joseph Ratzinger.
Before we talk about Joseph Ratzinger, you decided, as your doctoral work, to work on Karl Barth, the great Protestant theologian. There must have been a context in which you felt that you could do that, that that was a useful thing for the church, and the church permitted you to do that. Who were the people who actually shaped you to give you the impetus to say Barth is worth considering and studying?
Well, you know, when I was in the gymnasium, we call it, in Lucerne, Switzerland, often our teacher of history, he often asks, who are really internationally known Swiss of this time? And it was always Karl Barth who was mentioned, also because he was a man who strictly opposed the Nazis. He was professor in Germany and protest against the regime, and he was afterwards in Basel, Switzerland. And for me, he was especially a Swiss compatriot. But on the other hand, he has also written a tremendous church dogmatic, which was very attractive to read. And so I decided myself to make my dissertation on Karl Barth. But I had, fortunately, a very good spiritual father in the Pontifical German College in Rome, Jesuit Wilhelm Klein, who said that's a good thing and who supported me. So I was able then to write this dissertation, which appeared with a preface of Karl Barth himself. And because I was able to find a consensus in the most difficult question of the Reformation, this book became immediately famous, especially by the consensus of Karl Barth. So I did not expect to go to a university. I wanted to become a pastor for the youth. I come from the Catholic youth movement, and I probably thought I would be a pastor in a Swiss city. That was the reason why I wanted to have a doctorate, for having the same academic status as anybody else. But then this dissertation was, so to speak, the reason why I was called to a German university.
You did the dissertation not just on Bach, but as you mentioned, on the central problem of the Reformation, justification. Now that, of course, bore fruit many years later when we saw the Lutherans and the Catholics able to come together only in the last decade on some of these important questions.
Yes, I was very happy that finally they made this, but, you know, I was not invited to the ceremony, and I know that I was the first on the list, but my name was crossed out in the Vatican. I was not sad about it. I was just happy that they found a consensus. As a matter of fact, they could have easily done it some decades earlier and in an easier way. It was, again, a lot of discussion about certain formulas of the Council of Trent and of the reformers. I think it was a rather complicated discussion. That was already an indication that Rome didn't want to have really a document which was really straight, which was clear. It was, to a certain extent, a compromise. But nevertheless, it was good to have this agreement.
You say lightly that, oh, well, they didn't invite me, but yeah, that's okay, at least they did it. That still must touch you at some point. In some ways, it goes to the heart of the nature of the faith, as the sort of the generous side of the life of Christ. So in some ways, the attitude of the church there, although you can understand it, it still must have some impact on your understanding of the way the church expresses Christ.
Well, sure. I think it became more and more a problem for me until today, as a matter of fact, that the distance between Jesus of Nazareth and the first communities and now the present church is too big. And if you read just my short history of the Catholic Church, and I got several reactions also here from Australia who read this short history, it is nevertheless very surprising what kind of development the Catholic Church went through in all these 20 centuries. I think my desires for reform were always founded in the figure of Jesus Christ himself, and not just what is modern, what is up to date. Of course, the church has to modernize, but the criteria has to be Jesus Christ himself. And because I was convinced that he would treat the divorced people in a different way, that he would not put heavy burdens on the shoulder of human beings, like the encyclical Humanae Vitae on birth control, because he did not ask for an obligatory celibacy, I knew that I was on the right track and that the church authorities were on the wrong track. So I think that is, for me, the criterion of my interventions. If I would be sure that Jesus himself would like to have a law of celibacy or this Roman centralism. But all what we have now is a product not of the gospel, but of the Middle Ages, of what I call the medieval paradigm of the church, of Christianity, precisely of the 11th century. The popes introduced this centralism, absolutism, also as this sort of clericalism we didn't have in the first millennium, and the law of celibacy.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest, Professor Dr. Hans Kuhn, and we're talking about his life and experience of the church and the world today. Hans Kuhn, we spoke a little earlier of your life in the church and the themes that have run through your life. We've spoken particularly about ecumenism. Let's wind up that part of the conversation by talking about what's happened over the last 30 to 40 years. We've seen, in some ways, a retreat from those grand ecumenical objectives. But in some ways, we've also seen a broader cultural retreat. The church seems to identify things in terms of the rise in tide in secularism in the West. So it's become a battle over secularism versus orthodoxy, and some of the internal concerns of the church seem more shaped by those fears than they do about the sorts of progressive and open ideas that so moved the generation, the young generation that you were part of?
Well, it's rather difficult to analyze the situation. If people who are interested, and I just heard several Australian men and women who told me, I read your memoirs, the first volume, A Battle for Freedom, and the second, just published recently in England, Disputed Truth. There you have the whole story, which is, I think, not only my own life, but the history of the church before the council, in the council, after the council. Then you get a very complex vision of the things which happened also behind the scenery, not only on scene, behind the scenery. And then you see that we had already to face in the council itself a constant resistance of the Roman Curia. They didn't want to have a declaration on religious freedom. They opposed the declaration on the Jews and the both religions. They were, of course, opposed to the reform of the liturgy, of ecumenism. So everybody wondered a little how it will be after the council. Now, after the council, under Pope Paul VI, we still had an ambivalent situation, because Pope Paul, which had a great personal sympathy for myself, and I knew him personally, he was nevertheless a man of the council. He thought we should do certain things, so he introduced vernacular language also for the canon of the Mass and similar things. Mm-hmm. But with the arrival of the Polish Pope, then everything changed. And we are now really in a process of restoration, which is in many ways the opposite of what the council wanted to have.
The spirit that seems to drive your understanding of the church seems to reflect an old dilemma, that is the tension between right thinking and right action. The Jesus for you is the man of right action. The church has been dominated by a need to preserve right thought, or as the church sees, right thought first. So in some ways I see in the strands of your writing and what you say, an emphasis on charitable act, an emphasis on what would Jesus do, as you say. And that seems to be part of the tension?
I'm not so sure. I think the message of Jesus is more important than all the dogmas of the church. It's also a question of theory, not only of practice. I think they replaced, to a great extent, the message of the Sermon on the Mount and of the whole evangelical message. They replaced in Rome by canon law, by medieval theology, and by a constitution of the church which has not enough foundation in the early communities. So we got more and more an opposition between the two. I think if you would imagine that Jesus would come back, as in the famous story of Dostoevsky in The Brother Karamazov, when Jesus comes back to the Grand Inquisitor, well, what would happen? Can you imagine that he would be present in a liturgy of the Pope in St. Peter's? Can you imagine that he would pray with President Bush and the birthday? I think, you know, only to take these symbolic actions show you that these are the actions and the message of Jesus are very different from what we do. And a lot of people feel that. They say, well, that's the reason why I do not want to participate anymore in the church. I think we have to take this very seriously.
Let's go to 1968, when Joseph Ratzinger, somebody you'd worked with through the council, sees the student revolts around the world, sees something in society that worries him. And he takes a view that the progressivism, that the openness, has problems with it. And that also makes a break with you. What was the nature of the break? Is the break essentially theological? Is it a sensibility about the nature of engagement with the world?
It's a multidimensional break, if you want to analyze the situation. Again, I have to refer to, as a matter of fact, the memoirs of Joseph Ratzinger, which are very short, but many pages about Tübingen of the year 68. and my own memoirs, then you see that the situation was, of course, complex. We were both disturbed by student revolts in our lectures, what was very embarrassing, and I didn't like these acts of violence, and in this way we were not divided. We opposed both this movement in so far as it was just violent demonstrations. But on the other hand, I think the difference was already that I saw a great deal of truth in these revolts of students, that a reform of the university is necessary, that the reform has also been a reform of society, and many desires of this student generation were justified. So I remained in Tübingen. I saw that everything was then more moderate. But Joseph Ratzinger left for Regensburg and went to a rather conservative university in Bavaria, Regensburg, and he entered the hierarchy. And since he left then his chair of theology, he became more conservative and a man of the Roman system. I make a big distinction between the Roman system, which developed since the 11th century in the West, not in the East, and the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is more than the system. Let me just tell you something I have not to miss. Basically, of course, his change was prepared. He comes, as I come, from a very conservative Catholic background. I'm from Switzerland, he from Bavaria. But my own Catholicism was already much more open than his. I traveled already a great deal as a young man, as a Swiss. Soon I was able to go already around Europe, and in Germany it was still very difficult. And I think he would agree that he is the man of the Roman Catholic paradigm of Christianity. But the Roman Catholic paradigm is only number three. We have first the Judeo-Christian paradigm, and he does not talk about that. Jesus, the disciples, the first communities were Jews. We have then second, the Hellenistic paradigm of the Roman Empire, and he uses only partly this paradigm. He is a man of the third paradigm, which came out after the time when the emperor had left Rome and the bishops of Rome became more and more popes. And his great theologian is not the Greek theologian, and he is not so much rooted in the New Testament than in St. Augustine and in the Middle Ages. And he would say that the liturgy of the Middle Ages were great, and they are still great. So I think that is the reason why he has then no understanding of the paradigm four, the Reformation, and even less for the paradigm five, that is the Enlightenment and the modern times.
You point to Augustine. That's an important moment because Augustine, too, is living in a time of what he sees as collapse of the order around him. And now that resonates, you're suggesting, with Benedict quite powerfully, that in some ways he is there. Does that explain, for example, the encyclicals? Does that explain that his first concern is to protect and preserve the church?
Yes, I think he has also sometimes, as Augustine, the old Augustine, not the younger one, the old Augustine has, of course, eschatological, he thinks that the end of the Roman Empire is the end of the world, and he was very, very pessimistic. Also, Joseph Ratzinger became more pessimistic. He tries to show himself sometimes joyful, but I think his vision of the church is rather pessimistic and has to do with this vision of St. Augustine. St. Augustine, of course, is also the man who invented the original sin. I think this was not known. If you look really at the Bible, the first book of Genesis, they do not speak about the transportation of the sin by the sexual act. It is certainly a sin which pervades the whole of humanity, but not because of sexuality. That is the difference. Now, Augustine, who had a rather sexy life in earlier times, he was then Manichaean a certain time, who opposed now the two positions of light and darkness and they despised sexuality, made it a bad thing. And I think St. Augustine has taken it over into his own theology, and he is really responsible for the theory that sin was transported by intercourse. It's a really terrible imagination. It's a terrible idea, because that was then the reason why the babies have to be baptized immediately. That is the reason why sexuality was considered as a bad thing. It has consequences until the encyclical Humanae Vitae, where we have a tendency just to insist that sexuality has to be used for procreation and so on. All these is, I think, the background. And I can understand that also now Pope Benedict does not want to change to correct the encyclical Humanae Vitae on birth control, which is, as a matter of fact, after the Council, also in 1968, the main reason why a lot of people in the Catholic Church do not believe anymore in an infallible authority of the Pope.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you, our guest, Dr. Hans Kung. And we're talking about the Church and his life in the Church and the Church in the world. Dr. Kung, we're just talking about the Church and the way in which Augustinian theology has influenced things. You've also written about science and the Church. And there's a sense in which science is about discovering the world, your sense discovering God's good creation. That Augustinian view can also have a view that, well, the creation is fallen, so it's something that is tainted in some way. Is this also a tension that you see in the Church's relationship to the things of the world and the way it deals with science?
Well, in this respect, I would defend Joseph Ratzinger. As you may know, I had a 4 hours dialogue with him in Casa Gandolfo in a very friendly way with a common meal at the end. And he was very happy with my book, The Beginning of All Things is its title, about science and religion, because he thinks it's really necessary to have harmony between the two. So I think in this respect, he is also not hindered by St. Augustine, who has not specific ideas which are hindering us. It's more the case of Galileo afterwards, who made troubles in all these centuries, and the case of Charles Darwin, of course. But I think, as a matter of fact, in the communique, the official communique of the Vatican, after this dialogue, which the Pope wrote himself, with my approval, as a matter of fact, a unique event in the history of the Church, it is explicitly said that we need this dialogue between religion and science and so on. So I think here we are on common ground.
The common ground is very important to find these days, particularly as the Church faces the environmental crisis, and you've spoken very strongly about the need for a common humanity, a common understanding. What are the critical issues for you, and how can the Church positively contribute?
Well, that is, of course, a thing which is much bigger than the Church. I think it would already be important that this difficulty a lot of people have with the theory of evolution would be seen in a positive way. I stress in my book the insight that if you look into the status of astrophysics first, but then also of biology, then I think you have a greater idea of God than before, because it remains an issue: why is there a Big Bang? A question no astrophysicist can answer. Why is there anything and not nothing? Why is there here a world? Where are we coming from? Where are we going to? I think these questions are still questions the Church should answer in a constructive way, not against science, but with the sciences, because a lot of people would like to know that. Now, with regard to climate change, of course, the Church can support everything what is said, that we need another economy in order to have also an ecology, in order to have economy and ecology combined. And here there is, of course, a great deal of societal change necessary. We cannot live forever increasing the oxygen in the air, and all the problems we have with the water, with the air, with the earth. Here, I think the church can do a great deal of things, but may I mention just one aspect which is generally not treated? The population problem is, of course, a basic problem. I just come from China. I was in Beijing again 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago. If you see the streets and if you know the problems the Chinese government has in order to control the birth rate, and they had used several methods which may not be the best ones. Nevertheless, it has to be acknowledged that especially in Africa, in Asia, this is a major problem. And here the church could do a great thing. But if we still have the message, increase and multiply, what Pope John Paul II declared precisely in Nairobi. He was not in the slums as I was there, which was not prepared when I came. Then you see what it means if children cannot anymore find a school, if they have not enough to live, if they have no future. Then to say increase and multiply is really absolutely, well, it's just not to understand. And the Catholic Church could have changed a great deal of things if the Pope would have given a reasonable answer to the question of birth control. I had a conversation, private conversation with Pope Paul at the end of the council. Unfortunately, I didn't know that it was not so much a problem for him of sexuality, but of infallibility. But the Pope could have written a very good encyclical about sexuality in the present world, which would oppose on one side libertarianism, that anything goes, and on the other side rigorism, that nothing goes. So we got this unhappy encyclical, but we do not have a way which is positive for sexuality as a great force in human life and human society, which has to be appreciated positively, and on the other hand, which has also to be handled reasonably. So I think here the church could do a great deal of things if they would have an understand in the questions of population and not hinder progress as in the population conference in Cairo, where they opposed even the pill and all the rest.
Yet here, of course, Benedict's first encyclical may have been the beginnings of a way forward.
Yes, I think his encyclicals have a great deal of good elements, and I think I also thanked him personally for the last encyclical about charity, about love. Only people are now asking if he has veritas in caritate, the truth in love. Where is the love of the church? Where is the love of the church of the divorced people who are in troubles? Where is the love of the church for priests who have problems with celibacy? Where is the love of people who have problems with AIDS and condom, etc.? Where is the love of the church in ecumenical relations? Where is the love of the church for establishing the Eucharist in community with Protestants and Anglicans? All these are problems of practical love. And so people are waiting for actions and not only for words.
Dr. Hans Kung, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you. I hope to come back sometimes to Australia, but after my 82nd birthday, it will be a little difficult, I believe.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.